Admiral James Stavridis, U.S. Navy retired, is now Dean of the Fletcher School at Tufts University and a former NATO Supreme Allied Commander. Admiral, it's a pleasure to speak to you. You, along with Bill Lynn, were leaders of the Creative Disruption Task Force at the Center for a New American Security. And they identified their mission as looking at trends in the technology, security, and business environments, highlighting disruptive effects in these trends and offering recommendations for improving the United States' ability to harness new sources of innovation. They write about a growing disconnect between DoD needs and what industry can provide them. Where do you see that disconnect being greatest, and what do you think the greatest potential is to bring the two sides back together?
Francis, first, thanks for having me on the show. It's a pleasure to be talking to you. In terms of the disconnects, I think there's a couple of ways to look at it. One is there's a bit of a temporal disconnect in terms of the length of time it takes to go from concept to fielding to the prototyping that's required in the middle, the testing, the evaluation. The process is just simply too long, and I think that temporal disconnect is something that needs to be addressed, frankly, by both sides. Because let's face it, partly that's the result of the government's cumbersome process and contracting and how we lay out requirements, and partly it's a result of conservative approaches on the side of business and so forth. So that's an area that I think a disconnect of a temporal nature that I think should be addressed. Secondly, I think there's a risk disconnect in the sense that for perfectly understandable business reasons, the defense industry takes an extremely conservative approach to production in defense systems. And at the same time, the U.S. government takes a very conservative approach because they're very mindful, as they should be, of taxpayer funding and making sure that we make the right decisions and we protect at all costs the lives of our troops upon whom they depend so often with these systems. But that leaves us in a world in which we're not at least occasionally swinging for the fences and really trying out new concepts. We do a little bit of this, of course, with DARPA, but frankly, we need a bigger, more muscular version of DARPA to really address the need to take some risk in some of the programs we ought to be pursuing, because events are changing so quickly on the battlefield in front of us. So I think those are the two principal types of disconnects that I see.
The word that I hear most commonly from both current and former Pentagon officials on the civilian side, sir, regarding the risk disconnect is incentive. And there is no incentive, especially in the acquisition shop at the Defense Department, at least right now it seems, to take any risks. And that leads to the proliferation of what industry says, at least, of low-priced, technically acceptable type contracts, and an environment where the perception at least exists that the Pentagon says, bring us your innovation, but you spend all the money and show us what you got, and then we'll decide if it's something we want to invest in and provide a path to you for you to make your investment back. Is that a fair perception, and is the Pentagon maybe being too risk averse and in not being willing to swing for the fences?
Yes, it is a very fair criticism. And I think what it screams to me is the need for a better private-public cooperation so we can kind of share that risk. The government shares risk in a lot of other areas for us as taxpayers. We share risk essentially in the entire concept of defense. We pay for it through tax dollars, and we share risk. We share risk in disaster relief and disaster response. We share risk in buying a national highway system. So I'm not sure why we shouldn't be willing on both the government side and to some degree on the private sector side, where businesses take risk all the time with investments they make. But I think where it gets unfair is where government tries to push all the risk over to the private sector. And at the moment, I think the rheostat is dialed in that direction. That's why I think the criticism is fair. And we need to move that rheostat back a bit. Again, an organization like DARPA, but bigger, more muscular, with more resources, I think could share that kind of risk more effectively earlier in the production cycle.
Is a healthier private-public industry-DoD relationship something that we've had historically and have gotten away from, or is it something that we've never really cultivated the way that we could, and now we're finding ourselves coming up on the short end of that lack of production in the past?
Yeah, that's a terrific and a very historically perceptive question. My own view is that we enjoyed a much closer set of relationships, probably coming out of the World War II experience, where necessity drove us in that direction. And as you know, there was a great deal of the, what we think of today as the defense industry was really the government. We emerged from that. We went through the 50s, and then, of course, famously, President Eisenhower, a former soldier who became president, identified the risks of what he called the military-industrial complex. And I think there was a rise of suspicion. Partly this was tied in the 60s to animus that came out of the war in Vietnam and then the suspicions that arose out of Watergate. A big, complicated picture, but we have enjoyed a better relationship in the past. We don't have to create a world in which there's a pure profit-making revolving door, which was Eisenhower's concern. But I think we can get industry and the private sector together more effectively if we do it in the ways that we've outlined in the report that we're talking about today.
Admiral Stavridis collaborated on that report with his co-leader, Bill Lynn, the former Deputy Secretary of Defense, Creative Disruption Technology Strategy and the Future of the Global Defense Industry from the Center for a New American Security. And Secretary Lynn was on the program not too long ago, Admiral, talking about the landscape of the defense industry and how differently it looked, not only between today and the post-World War II era that you talked about a moment ago, but even between today and the end of the Cold War in the early 1990s when he first went into the Department of Defense. And I wonder if the kinds of collaborations that you're talking about work well from an industry perspective, because we have now a quarterly earnings cycle that these companies feel obligated to report on, obviously, because their shareholders expect it. But that I don't recall that emphasis on earnings quarter after quarter after quarter being there during the last defense drawdown and during the last major reshaping of the defense industrial base.
Yeah, I think that's a perceptive comment. And it goes in line generally with the intense scrutiny that hangs fairly enough over all government expenditures in a period of time when our economy is under pressure. So it's understandable, but I think it does have a chilling effect on the thinking and the ability to kind of play the long game in some of these companies.
We've focused so far in our conversation, Admiral, on the United States, and kind of we've gazed at our own navel for a few moments. And I want to expand that because you and your colleagues in the work that you did, and Ben Fitzgerald and Kelly Saylor of CNAS in this work, focus on where the United States fits in the global picture. One of the comments that they write is the major powers of the 20th century still retain privileged access to advanced military capabilities in sufficient quantities to achieve their national priorities in the short term, but the medium and long-term pictures look decidedly more ominous. It strikes me that that is troubling for two reasons. Lesser powers and non-state actors have the ability, in some cases, to get some of the advanced military capabilities, and in some cases, they're using very effectively far less sophisticated weapons that almost fly below, no pun intended, the radar screen of advanced military powers. Is there one or the other of those that we should be watching that maybe we haven't watched as much as we should have?
I think we should watch both of those, and I'll give you a third one to watch, which is somewhat related to both of them, but it's a little bit different and nuanced. Remember when we would talk 10 to 15 years ago about the revolution in military affairs? You remember that term, the RMA?
Yes.
And it's related to the ideas that you just articulated. I wrote a piece, I think about 10 years ago, called The Second Revolution. In other words, if we really were going through this revolution in military affairs, what's the second revolution? I think that is the third aspect of this that's very challenging. And what I think the second revolution is, the ability of these kind of actors, both small state and non-state, to take the R&D investments and create, if you will, reverse engineered, far simpler, taking advantage of fast technology cycles to produce both asymmetric weapon systems and new, if you will, symmetric weapon systems, taking advantage of all the research and development costs that we've incurred during the first revolution, if you will. So I think it's the two things you mentioned and then that third aspect of it. So the question is, what should we do about it? And it goes back to where we started our conversation, Francis, which is we've got the intellectual firepower. We've got the capability in our laboratories. We've got the bright people. What we don't have is a process that allows them to engage rapidly. Other than a few labs around the country and a DARPA-like entity, and we need to, again, that was the point of the whole paper we wrote, was to try and create a new system of processes that can harness those kinds of things and keep us ahead on these big and emerging technologies.
The very nature of the work that you and Bill and the rest of your team did is, I think, the importance of it is borne out in what we're seeing happening in Iraq and in Syria right now. I don't know for a fact, but it strikes me as highly unlikely that ISIL has an acquisition department. Somebody decides they need something, and despite the fact that they are seemingly a very organized operation, they go and figure out a way to get it, from what I understand, almost ad hoc. So yep. The fact that we have an infrastructure at all, I think, goes right to the disadvantage that we start out with. Mm-hmm. So maybe we should back up a minute and talk about the nature of an infrastructure operation on one side where the enemy has no infrastructure, and talk about that inherent disadvantage that we start out with, sir.
Mm-hmm. I think that's right. Another way to put that, so often our weaknesses can become our strengths if we think about them consciously. And so if our weakness, as you correctly point out, is this big infrastructure, what we ought to be thinking about is, look at the resources we put into creating this big infrastructure. How can they be reshaped in order to create something that's more nimble, that's faster, that kind of resembles the Islamic State's acquisition department, which is full of risk takers, not overly burdened with regulation, is willing to try new things constantly, to innovate, and is highly nimble and mobile and probably not tied down to a big bricks and mortar structure. How do we do that? I think we're smart enough to figure that out. And I think that's the challenge that is really front and center in the acquisition world for those in the security segment at the moment.
I wonder if you think that we do approach the chain of capability to technology to procurement in a different way than maybe our potential adversaries do. It strikes me that the first thing that you and your colleagues in military leadership advise civilian leadership that you need is a better way to achieve a particular mission. The end result is a better way to defeat the enemy. That then manifests itself in the form of a potentially new piece of equipment, a new aircraft or new ship, whatever. And that then becomes the technology. And then how do we get a new airplane takes us to the acquisition piece. Mm-hmm. Do we spend enough time, do you think, at the beginning part, at the capability part, and in then making sure that when we get to the technology piece that we have exactly what we need capability-wise and only what we need capability-wise before we move to the acquisition piece, sir?
Yeah, I don't think we do. I think you're correct to point that out, and that would be part of the job of this new, more mobile, more nimble component in the acquisition process. I would also like to point out that you can stand what you just described on its head, I think, with some reasonable effect, which is to look at what we already have, what we've already created in the form of, let's say, cyber capability, of special forces capability, of unmanned capability that's already extant. It's on the shelf. But think about new ways to apply it or to synergize it. It's a different kind of acquisition, but it's taking existing components, capabilities, and and acquiring a new way to do business by combining them. And here I would say the three that I mentioned, cyber, unmanned, and special forces, can be combined to acquire a new way of doing a tactic, a technique, or a procedure that can fulfill a military need as well. So you don't always have to get out a blank piece of paper and start. You can also look at, what do I already have? What do other people have? Here we get into the global defense industry. What are other capabilities extant around the world? How can I acquire capability by combining those kinds of components, if you will, in new ways? That's a second part of acquisition that I think is worth exploring.
Admiral James Stavridis is Dean of the Fletcher School at Tufts University, former NATO Supreme Allied Commander and a co-leader, along with former Defense Secretary, Deputy Secretary of Defense Bill Lynn, of the Task Force on Creative Disruption, Technology, Strategy, and the Future of the Global Defense Industry, as led located at the Center for a New American Security. Admiral, your comment about global defense leads me to your experience at NATO, and you have a maybe not unique, but a very special opportunity when you were Supreme Allied Commander to intimately know what our NATO allies can do and what they can't do. And one of the things that Secretary Lynn and I have talked about before is the need, if they're not on it already, for NATO to conduct an assessment of their member countries, or maybe it's something that it winds up living within the European Union, one way or the other, but for them to think about defense and projecting power in a more of a team environment where not every country has to have every capability. Mm-hmm. What did you see as Supreme Allied Commander? What do you see in your as you look at this as an observer in the private sector now? And where would you like to see our allies, not just in NATO, not just in the EU, but around the world, as mm-hmm. far as a holistic capability, rather than everybody thinking they've got to be in business for themselves?
Yeah, the degree to which Europe will be successful as an entity in creating security and indeed in conducting diplomacy, especially with the military instrument in this century, will depend upon the degree to which they are willing to do exactly what you just articulated, which is to operate together such that each nation doesn't have to have diesel submarines. Each nation doesn't have to have nuclear submarines. Each nation doesn't need fifth-generation fighters, but rather one nation can specialize in the diesels, one can have the nuclear submarines, another can have fifth-generation fighters. That process, that idea, that concept is often called smart defense within the halls of NATO. I would say the Europeans are moving in that direction, but they need to accelerate the move. The good news is the Europeans spend almost $300 billion a year on defense, which is about half of what the U.S. spends, but it's triple what the Russians spend, for example. It's double what the Chinese spend, for example. So they're spending a lot of money on defense, but they're misallocating it because of duplication, and that drives down the overall capability that could be available if they spent it the way you and I just talked about. I think the light is flickering. It needs to go fully on, and when it does, and I think it will, Europe will become even more capable and formidable as an ally, friend, and partner to the United States.
And that provides a tremendous amount of relief to the United States as either the leader or sole provider of security in a number of hotspots around the world, I imagine.
It does, and we should say the same thing to a somewhat lesser degree, but still importantly, about the Pacific, where Japan, South Korea, and Australia, when you combine their defense spending, come in with a respectable amount of defense. The Japanese, in particular, have very capable systems at sea and in air defense. And so the same idea can apply in Asia. It won't have the same structure that it does in NATO, but the degree to which the United States can build this global coalition of close allies, friends, and partners takes pressure off us, takes pressure off our economy. I think we all have learned that unilateral action in today's world is often not the best way. It's when you can go multilateral with allies and partners, you will do a lot better. It'll be more efficient, and you'll have to leave less of your own money, capability, and most importantly, blood and treasure on the table.
So it seems to me the argument then that the United States or somebody has to make to our NATO and European allies is, you can do what you're doing now, which is own a small military that's marginally powerful and marginally influential, or you can become a part owner of something that can compete with and project power in an equivalent way to the superpowers of the world, Russia, China, the United States. And on the surface, that sounds like that's not a difficult case to make. I understand we have anywhere from 500 to 1,000 years of precedent to overcome in the case of some of these countries, and I don't mean to undersell that, but it strikes me that that's the case to make. Am I on target there, or is there something that I've missed?
No, you're absolutely on target, and in terms of that history, I'd say it's actually 2,000 years of history. For 2,000 years, the Europeans have been going to war with each other.
Fair enough.
And in the last century, the Europeans killed 60 million Europeans in two world wars. The good news is, after 2,000 misspent years, over the last 60 years, they've created a European Union, they've joined NATO. They've created a European defense and diplomatic service together. Increasingly, they act in a unified way. They still cling to their precious nationalism at certain times, but I think if you look at the trends, they're moving in the right direction. No one today seriously imagines a world in which France and Germany go to war, but that was the story of hundreds of years of European history until the end of the Second World War. It's also, by the way, a good argument. What has happened in Europe is a good argument for U.S. engagement and involvement. Part of why Europe is coherent and whole is because the United States has remained engaged in Europe. Unlike at the end of the First World War, when we came back to the United States in a fit of isolationism, we withdrew from the League of Nations. That led to the Second World War. We learned that lesson. We stayed engaged. We created the NATO alliance. Today, our most powerful pool of partners in the world is in Europe. So it's a lesson not only for the Europeans, but also for the U.S., in my view.
Admiral Stavridis, we just have a few moments left, and I appreciate your time very much today. You and your colleagues, through this Center for a New American Security report, make three recommendations, and I want to talk about each of them in turn briefly before we wrap up.
Sure.
The first is to develop an acquisition strategy for the 21st century, and we've kind of walked around that without jumping right in the middle of the ring. What are the key elements that must change, in your view, in the DoD acquisition chain before we can say we now have an acquisition strategy for the 21st century?
I think they're well articulated in the report, but just to summarize a couple that I think are particularly important, we need to relieve the burden of very cumbersome regulation. We need to allow industry to profitably take some risk and balance the load sharing, if you will, between the government side and the private sector side. And we need more pure innovation, more DARPA-like activity in our approach to taking on new ideas and tasks.
The next one is to undertake reform to update defense structures. And that's far easier said than done, because you're looking at things, as you mentioned, like regulatory reform, intellectual property reform, which I know the companies are screaming for, and improved communication with the market. The Office of Management and Budget, in particular the Office of Federal Procurement Policy, has been talking about this for two or three years now. But vendors say they're, especially in the DoD side, they're not seeing much progress made as far as being able to communicate with the stakeholders, especially on requirements.
Yeah, and this is one of the fundamental reasons we wanted to write the report, was to continue to push, to continue to have the conversation. As you know, the people involved in this report are defense leaders in every dimension, in industry and practitioner side and government. I think by keeping the pressure on, collectively, we can, over time, move this in the right direction.
The final recommendation from Ben Fitzgerald and Kelly Saylor, who wrote the report based on the work that you and your colleagues did on this task force, sir, was to increase defense industry innovation. And my sense, as we talked about earlier in our conversation, is that industry would love that, provided they get some certainty that they can see a path to making their money back on whatever they invest in the R&D up front to provide that innovation to the department.
Yeah, and I think that's a very fair feeling on the part of industry, recognizing that part of business is risk. And for any private company, you do take risk when you create a new product. So it's fair that you take some risk, but I don't think industry should be asked to take all the risk. So it's not an on and off switch. It's not government ought to take all risk or industry ought to take all risk. We ought to be able to dial that rheostat in an intelligent way.